us be a gay beard. I have an idea, June finally half shouts. When they both look at her, she's biting her lip, looking at Alex. But I don't know if you're gonna like it. She turns her phone around to show them the screen. It's a photo he recognizes as one of the ones they took for Pez in Texas, June and Henry lounging on the dock together. She's cropped Nora out, so it's just the two of them, Henry sporting a wide, teasing grin under his sunglasses, and June planting a kiss on his cheek. I was on that floor too, she says. We don't have to, like, confirm or deny anything, but we can imply something, just to take the heat off. Alex swallows. He's always known June was one inch from taking a bullet for him. But this? He would never ask her to do this. But the thing is, it would work. Their social media friendship is well documented, even if half of it is gifs of Colin Firth. Out of context, the photo looks as couple-y as anything, like a nice, gorgeous, heterosexual couple on vacation together. He looks over to Zara. It's not a bad idea, Zara says. We'd have to get Henry on board. Can you do that? Alex releases a breath. He absolutely doesn't want this, but he's also not sure what other choice he has. I think so. This is exactly what we said we didn't want to do, Alex says into his phone. I know, Henry tells him across the line. His voice is shaky. Philip is waiting on Henry's other line. But. Yeah, Alex says. But. June posts the picture from Texas, and it immediately burns through her stats to become her new, most liked post. Within hours, it's everywhere. BuzzFeed puts up a comprehensive guide to Henry and June's relationship, leading off with that goddamn photo of them dancing at the royal wedding. They dig up photos from the night in L.A., analyze Twitter interactions. Just when you thought June Claremont Diaz couldn't get any more hashtag goals, one article writes, has she secretly had her own Prince Charming all along? Another one speculates, did HRH's best friend Alex introduce them? June's relieved, only because she managed to find a way to protect him, even though it means the world is digging through her life for answers and evidence, which makes Alex want to murder everyone. He also wants to grab people by the shoulders and shake them and tell them Henry is his, you idiots, even though the whole point of this was for it to be believable. He shouldn't feel wronged deep in his gut, but that everyone seems enamored when the only difference between the lie and the truth that would burn up Fox News is the gender involved. Well, it fucking stings. Henry is quiet. He says enough for Alex to glean that Philip is apoplectic, and Her Majesty is annoyed, but pleased Henry has finally found himself a girlfriend. Alex feels horrible about it. The stifling orders, pretending to be someone he's not. Alex has always tried to be a refuge for Henry from it all. It was never supposed to come from his side, too. It's bad. It's stomach cramps, walls closing in, no plan B if this fails bad. He was in London barely 2 weeks ago, kissing Henry in front of a Giambologna. Now this. There's another piece in their back pocket that'll sell it. The only relationship in his life that can get more mileage than any of this. Nora comes to him at the residence wearing bright red lipstick and presses cool, patient fingers against his temples, and says, take me on a date. They choose a college neighborhood full of people who sneak shots on their phones and post them everywhere. Nora slides her hand into his back pocket, and he tries to focus on the comfort of her physical presence against his side, the familiar frizz of her curls against his cheek. For half a second, he allows a small part of him to think about how much easier things would be if this were the truth. Sliding back into comfortable, easy harmony with his best friend, leaving greasy fingerprints along her waistline outside Jumbo Slice, laughing at her crass jokes. If he could love her like people wanted him to, and she loved him, and there wasn't any more to it than that. But she doesn't, and he can't. and his heart is on a plane over the Atlantic right now, coming to D.C. to seal the deal over a well-photographed lunch with June the next day. Zara sends him an email full of Twitter threads about him and Nora that night when he's in bed, and he feels sick. Henry lands in the middle of the night and isn't even allowed to come near the residence, instead sequestered in a hotel across town. He sounds exhausted when he calls in the morning, and Alex holds the phone close and promises he'll try to find a way to see him before he flies back out.
"Please," Henry says, paper thin.
His mother, the rest of the administration, and half of the press at this point are caught up for the day dealing with news of a North Korean missile test. Nobody notices when June lets him climb into her SUV with her that morning. June holds onto his elbow and makes half-hearted jokes, and when they pull up a block from the cafe, she offers him an apologetic smile.
"I'll tell him you're here," she says. "If nothing else, maybe that'll make it a little easier for him."
"Thanks," he says. Before she opens the door to leave, he catches her by the wrist and says,
"Seriously, thank you."
She gives his hand a squeeze, and she and Amy are gone. And he's alone in a tiny, secluded alleyway with a second car of backup security and a twisted-up feeling in his stomach. It takes all of an hour before June texts him,
"All done,"
followed by,
"Bringing him to you."
They worked it out before they left. Amy brings June and Henry back to the alley. They have him swap cars like a political prisoner. Alex leans forward to the two agents sitting silently in the front seats. He doesn't know if they've figured out what this really is yet, and he honestly doesn't care.
"Hey, can I have a minute?"
They exchange a look but get out, and a minute later, there's another car alongside him and the door is opening. And he's there, Henry, looking tense and unhappy, but within arm's reach. Alex pulls him in by the shoulder on instinct, the door shutting behind him. He holds him there, and this close he can see the faint gray tinge to Henry's complexion, the way his eyes aren't connecting. It's the worst he's ever seen him, worse than a violent fit or the verge of tears. He looks hollowed out, vacant.
"Hey,"
Alex says. Henry's gaze is still unfocused, and Alex shifts toward the middle of the seat and into his line of vision.
"Hey, look at me. Hey, I'm right here."
Henry's hands are shaking, his breath's coming shallow, and Alex knows the signs, the low hum of an impending panic attack. He reaches down and wraps his hand around one of Henry's wrists, feeling the racing pulse under his thumbs. Henry finally meets his eyes.
"I hate it," he says. "I hate this."
"I know,"
Alex says.
"It was tolerable before, somehow," Henry says. "When there was never the possibility of anything else. But Christ, this is, it's vile. It's a bloody farce. And June and Nora, what, they just get to be used? Gran wanted me to bring my own photographers for this. Did you know that?"
He inhales, and it gets caught in his throat and shudders violently on the way back out.
"Alex, I don't want to do this."
"I know,"
Alex tells him again, reaching up to smooth out Henry's brow with a pat of his thumb.
"I know. I hate it too. It's not fucking fair,"
he goes on, his voice nearly breaking.
"My shit ancestors walking around doing 1,000 times worse than any of this, and nobody cared."
"Baby,"
Alex says, moving his hand to Henry's chin to bring him back down.
"I know. I'm so sorry, babe, but it won't be like this forever, okay? I promise."
Henry closes his eyes and exhales through his nose.
"I want to believe you. I do. But I'm so afraid I'll never be allowed."
Alex wants to go to war for this man. Wants to get his hands on everything and everyone that ever hurt him. But for once, he's trying to be the steady one. So he rubs the side of Henry's neck gently until his eyes drift back open and he smiles softly, tipping their foreheads together.
"Hey," he says, "I'm not going to let that happen. Listen, I'm telling you right now, I will physically fight your grandmother myself if I have to, okay? And like she's old, I know I can take her.
I wouldn't be so cocky, Henry says with a small laugh. She's full of dark surprises.
Alex laughs, cuffing him on the shoulder.
Seriously, he says.
Henry's looking back at him, beautiful and vital and heartsick, and still always the person Alex is willing to risk ruining his life for.
I hate this so much. I know. But we're gonna do it together. And we're gonna make it work. You and me and history. Remember? We're just gonna fucking fight. Because you're it, okay? I'm never gonna love anybody in the world like I love you. So I promise you, one day we'll be able to just be and fuck everyone else.
He pulls Henry in by the nape of his neck and kisses him hard. Henry's knee knocking against the center console as his hands move up to Alex's face. Even though the windows are tinted black, it's the closest they've ever come to kissing in public. And Alex knows it's reckless, but all he can think is a supercut of other people's letters they've quietly sent to each other. Words that went down in history. Meet you in every dream. Keep most of your heart in Washington. Miss you like a home. We two longing loves. My young king.
One day, he tells himself. One day. Us two.
The anxiety feels like buzzing little wings in his ear, in the silence, like a petulant wasp. It catches him when he tries to sleep and startles him awake. Follows him on laps paced up and down the floors of the residence. It's getting harder to brush off the feeling he's being watched. The worst part is that there's no end in sight. They'll definitely have to keep it up at least until the election is over. And even then, there's the always looming possibility of the Queen outright forbidding it. His idealistic streak won't let him fully accept it. But that doesn't mean it isn't there. He keeps waking up in D.C., and Henry keeps waking up in London, and the whole world keeps waking up to talk about the two of them in love with other people. Pictures of Nora's hand in his, speculation about whether June will get an official announcement of royal courtship. And the two of them, Henry and Alex, like the world's worst illustration of the symposium, split down the middle and sent bleeding into separate lives. Even that thought depresses him, because Henry's the only reason he's become a person who cites Plato. Henry and his classics. Henry in his palace. In love. In misery. Not talking much anymore. Even with both of them trying as hard as they are, it's impossible to feel like it's not pulling them apart. The whole charade takes and takes from them. Takes days that were sacred. The night in L.A., the weekend at the lake, the missed chance in Rio, and records over the tape with something more palatable. The narrative, two fresh-faced young men who love two beautiful young women and definitely not ever each other. He doesn't want Henry to know. Henry has a hard enough time as it is, looked at sideways by his whole family. Philip, who knows and has not been kind. He tries to sound calm and whole over the phone when they talk, but he doesn't think it's convincing. When he was younger and the anxiety got this bad, when the stakes in his life were much, much lower, this would be the point of self-destruction. If he were in California, he'd sneak the Jeep out and drive way too fast down the 101, doors off, blasting NWA, inches from being painted on the pavement. In Texas, he'd steal a bottle of Makers from the liquor cabinet and get wasted with half the lacrosse team, and maybe, afterward, climb through Liam's window and hope to forget by morning. The first debate is in a matter of weeks. He doesn't even have work to keep him busy, so he stews and stresses and goes for long, punishing runs until he has the satisfaction of blisters. He wants to set himself on fire, but he can't afford for anyone to see him burn. He's returning a box of borrowed files to his dad's office in the Dirksen building after hours when he hears the faint sound of muddy waters from the floor above. And it hits him. There's one person he can burn down instead. He finds Rafael Luna hunched at his office's open window,
sucking down a cigarette. There are two empty, crumpled packs of Marlboros next to a lighter and an overflowing ashtray on the sill. When he turns around at the slam of the door, he coughs out a startled cloud of smoke.
"Those things are gonna fucking kill you," Alex says.
He said the same thing about 500 times that summer in Denver, but now he means, "I kinda wish they would."
"Kid,
don't call me that."
Luna turns, stubbing out his cigarette in the ashtray, and Alex can see a muscle clenching in his jaw. As handsome as he always is, he looks like shit.
"You shouldn't be here."
"No shit," Alex says. "I just wanted to see if you would have the balls to actually talk to me."
"You do realize you're talking to a United States senator," he says placidly.
"Yeah, big fucking man," Alex says. He's advancing on Luna now, kicking a chair out of the way. "Important fucking job. Hey, how about you tell me how you're serving the people who voted for you by being Jeffrey Richards' chicken shit little sellout?"
"What the hell did you come here for, Alex, eh?" Luna asks him, unmoved. "You gonna fight me?"
"I want you to tell me why."
His jaw clenches again.
"You wouldn't understand.
I swear to God, if you say I'm too young, I'm gonna lose my shit."
"This isn't you losing your shit,"
Luna asks mildly. And the look that crosses Alex's face must be murderous because he immediately puts a hand up.
"Okay. Bad timing. Look, I know it seems shitty, but there are moving parts at work here that you can't even imagine. You know, I'll always be indebted to your family for what you all have done for me, but
I don't give a shit about what you owe us. I trusted you," he says. "Don't condescend to me. You know as much as anyone what I'm capable of, what I've seen. If you told me, I would get it."
He's so close, he's practically breathing Luna's reeking cigarette smoke. And when he looks into his face, there's a flicker of recognition at the bloodshot, blackened eyes and the gaunt cheekbones. It reminds him of how Henry looked in the back of the Secret Service car.
"Does Richards have something on you?" he asks. "Is he making you do this?"
Luna hesitates.
"I'm doing this because it's what needs to be done, Alex. It was my choice, nobody else's."
"Then tell me why."
Luna takes a deep breath and says,
"No."
Alex imagines his fist in Luna's face and removes himself by two steps, out of range.
"You remember that night in Denver?" he says, measured, his voice quavering. "When we ordered pizza, and you showed me pictures of all the kids you fought for in court, and we drank that nice bottle of scotch from the mayor of Boulder? I remember lying on the floor of your office, on the ugly-ass carpet, drunk off my ass, thinking, God, I hope I can be like him. Because you were brave. Because you stood up for things. And I couldn't stop wondering how you had the nerve to get up and do what you do every day with everyone knowing what they know about you." Briefly, Alex thinks he's gotten through to Luna, from the way he closes his eyes and braces himself against the sill. But when he faces Alex again, his stare is hard.
"People don't know a damn thing about me. They don't know the half of it. And neither do you," he says. "Jesus, Alex, please don't be like me. Find another fucking role model."
Alex, finally at his limit, lifts his chin and spits out, "I already am like you."
It hangs in the air between them, as physical as the kicked-over chair. Luna blinks.
"What are you saying?"
"You know what I'm saying. I think you always knew, before I even did."
"You don't,"
he says, stammering, trying to put it off.
"You're not like me."
Alex levels his stare. "Close enough. And you know what I mean."
"Okay, fine, kid," Luna finally snaps. "You want me to be your fucking Sherpa? Here's my advice. Don't tell anyone. Go find a nice girl and marry her. You're luckier than me. You can do that, and it wouldn't even be a lie."
And what comes out of Alex's mouth comes so fast he has no chance to stop it, only divert it out of English at the last second in case it's overheard.
"Sería una mentira, porque no sería él."
It would be a lie, because it wouldn't be him.
He knows immediately Raff has caught his meaning, because he takes a sharp step backward, his back hitting the sill again.
You can't tell me this shit, Alex, he says, clawing inside his jacket until he finds and removes another pack of cigarettes.
He shakes one out and fumbles with a lighter.
What are you even thinking? I'm on the opponent's fucking campaign. I can't hear this. How can you possibly think you can be a politician like this?
Who fucking decided that politics had to be about lying and hiding and being something you're not?
It's always been that, Alex.
Since when did you buy into it? Alex spits. You, me, my family, the people we run with? We were going to be the honest ones. I have absolutely zero interest in being a politician with some perfect veneer and 2.5 kids. Didn't we decide it was supposed to be about helping people, about the fight? What part of that is so fucking irreconcilable with letting people see who I really am? Who you are, Raff?
Alex, please, please, Jesus Christ, you have to leave. I can't know this. You can't tell me this. You have to be more careful than this.
God, Alex says, voice bitter, his hands on his hips. You know, it's worse than trust. I believed in you.
I know you did, Luna says.
He's not even looking at Alex anymore.
I wish you hadn't. Now I need you to get out.
Raff,
Alex,
get out.
He goes, slamming the door behind him. Back at the residence, he tries to call Henry. He doesn't pick up, but he texts,
"Sorry, meeting with Philip. Love you."
He reaches under the bed and gropes in the dark until he finds it. A bottle of Maker's. The emergency stash.
"Salud,"
he mutters under his breath. And he unscrews the top. Subject: Bad Metaphors About Maps. From A. AGCD at eclair45.com, September 25th, 2020, 3:21 a.m. to Henry. H. I have had whiskey. Bear with me. There's this thing you do. This thing. It drives me crazy. I think about it all the time. There's a corner of your mouth and a place that it goes, pinched and worried, like you're afraid you're forgetting something. I used to hate it. I used to think it was your little tick of disapproval. But I've kissed your mouth, that corner, that place it goes so many times now. I've memorized it. Topography on the map of you, a world I'm still charting. I know it. I added it to the key. Here, inches to miles, I can multiply it out, read your latitude and longitude, recite your coordinates like La Rosaria. This thing, your mouth, its place, it's what you do when you're trying not to give yourself away. Not in the way that you do all the time, those empty, greedy grabs for you. I mean, the truth of you, the weird, perfect shape of your heart. The one on the outside of your chest. On the map of you, my fingers can always find the green hills, Wales, cool waters and a shore of white chalk, the ancient part of you carved out of stone in a prayerful circle, sacrosanct. Your spine's a ridge I'd die climbing. If I could spread it out on my desk, I'd find the corner of your mouth where it pinches with my fingers, and I'd smooth it away, and you'd be marked with the names of saints like all the old maps. I get the nomenclature now. Saints' names belong to miracles. Give yourself away sometimes, sweetheart. There's so much of you. Fucking yours. A. P.S. Wilfred Owen to Siegfried Sassoon, 1917. And you have fixed my life, however short. You did not light me. I was always a mad comet. But you have fixed me. I spun round you a satellite for a month, but shall swing out soon. A dark star in the orbit where you will blaze.
Subject, re, bad metaphors about maps. From Henry, hwales@kensingtonemail.com, September 25th, 2020, 6.07 a.m. 2 a. From Jean Cocteau to Jean Marais, 1939. Thank you from the bottom of my heart for having saved me. I was drowning, and you threw yourself into the water without hesitation, without a backward look. The sound of Alex's phone buzzing on his nightstand startles him out of a dead sleep. He falls halfway out of bed, fumbling to answer it.
Hello?
What did you do? Zara's voice nearly shouts. By the clicking of heels in the background and muttering swearing, she's running somewhere. Alex says. He rubs his eyes, trying to get his brain back online. What did he do? Be more specific? Check the fucking news, you horny little miscreant. How could you possibly be stupid enough to get photographed? I swear to God. Alex doesn't even hear the last part of what she says because his stomach has just dropped all the way down through the floor and into the fucking basements 2 floors below. Fuck. Hands shaking, he switches Zara to speaker, opens up Google, and types his own name. Breaking. Photos reveal romantic relationship between Prince Henry and Alex Claremont Diaz. OMFG. F. Sotis and Prince Henry totally doing it. The Oral Office. Read F. Sotis's steamy emails to Prince Henry. Royal family declines to comment on reports of Prince Henry's relationship with first son. 25 GIFs that perfectly describe our reaction when we heard about Prince Henry and F. Sotis. Don't let first son go down on me. A bubble of hysterical laughter emerges from his throat. His bedroom door flies open, and Zara slams on the light, a steely expression of rage barely concealing the sheer terror on her face. Alex's brain flashes to the panic button behind his headboard and wonders if the Secret Service will be able to find him before he bleeds out. You're on communications lockdown, she says, and instead of punching him, she snatches his phone out of his hand and shoves it down the front of her blouse, which has been buttoned wrong in her rush. She doesn't even blink at his state of half-nakedness, just dumps an armload of newspapers onto his bedspread. Queen Henry, 20 copies of the Daily Mail proclaim in gigantic letters, inside the prince's gay affair with the first son of the United States. The cover is splashed with a blown-up photo of what is undeniably himself and Henry kissing in the back seat of the car behind the cafe, apparently shot with a long-range lens through the windshield. Tinted windows. But he forgot about the fucking windshield. 2 smaller photos are inset on the bottom of the page. One of the shots of them on the Beekman's elevator, and a photo of them side by side at Wimbledon, him whispering something in Henry's ear while Henry smiles a soft, private smile. Fucking shitting hell! He is so fucked! Henry is so fucked! And Jesus Christ, his mother's campaign is fucked, and his political career is fucked, and his ears are ringing and he's going to throw up. Fuck! Alex says again, I need my phone. I have to call Henry. No, you do fucking not, Zara says. We don't know yet how the emails got out, so it's radio silence until we find the leak. What? Is Henry okay? God, Henry. All he can think about is Henry's big blue eyes looking terrified, Henry's breathing coming shallow and quick, locked in his bedroom in Kensington Palace and desperately alone, and his jaw locks up. Something burning in the back of his throat. The president is sitting down right now with as many members of the Office of Communications as we could drag out of bed at 3 in the morning, Zara tells him, ignoring his question. Her phone is buzzing nonstop in her hand. It's about to be gay DEFCON 5 in this administration. For God's sake, put some clothes on. Zara disappears into Alex's closet, and he flips the newspaper open to the story, his heart pounding. There are even more photos inside. He glances over the copy, but there's too much to even begin to process. On the second page, he sees them. Printed and annotated excerpts of their emails. One is labeled, Prince Henry, Secret Poet.
It begins with a line he's read about 1,000 times by now. "Should I tell you that when we're apart, your body comes back to me in dreams?"
"Fuck!" he says a third time, spiking the newspaper at the floor. "That one was his. It feels obscene to see it there. How the fuck did they get these?"
"Yep," Zara agrees. "You dirty did it." She throws a white button down and a pair of jeans at him, and he pitches himself out of bed. Zara gamely holds out an arm for him to steady himself while he pulls his pants up, and despite it all, he's struck with overwhelming gratitude for her.
"Listen, I need to talk to Henry as soon as possible. I can't even imagine. God, I need to talk to him."
"Get some shoes. We're running," Zara tells him. "Priority one is damage control, not feelings." He grabs a pair of sneakers, and they take off while he's still pulling them on, running west. His brain is struggling to keep up, running through about 5,000 possible ways this could go, imagining himself 10 years down the road being frozen out of Congress, plummeting approval ratings, Henry's name scratched off the line of succession, his mother losing re-election on a swing state's disapproval of him. He's so screwed, and he can't even decide who to be angriest with, himself, or the mail, or the monarchy, or the whole stupid country. He nearly crashes into Zara's back as she skids to a stop in front of a door. He pushes the door open, and the whole room goes silent. His mother stares at him from the head of the table and says flatly, "Out." At first, he thinks she's talking to him, but she cuts her eyes down to the people around the table with her.
"Was I not clear?
Everyone out now," she says.
"I need to talk to my son."
Chapter 13. "Sit down," his mother tells him, and Alex feels dread coiled deep in his stomach. He has no clue what to expect. Knowing your parent as the person who raised you isn't the same as being able to guess their moves as a world leader. He sits, and the silence hovers over them, his mother's hands folded in a considering pose against her lips. She looks exhausted.
"Are you okay?" she says finally.
When he looks up in surprise, there's no anger in her eyes. The president stands on the edge of a career-ending scandal, measures her breath evenly, and waits for her son to answer.
"Oh."
It hits him with sudden clarity that he hasn't at all stopped to consider his own feelings. There simply hasn't been the time. When he reaches for an emotion to name, he finds he can't pin one down, and something shudders inside him and shuts down completely. He doesn't often wish away his position in life, but in this moment he does. He wants to be having this conversation in a different life, just his mother sitting across from him at the dinner table, asking him how he feels about his nice, respectable boyfriend, if he's doing okay with figuring his identity out. Not like this. In a West Wing briefing room, his dirty email spread out between them on the table. He begins. To his horror, he hears something shake in his voice, which he quickly swallows down.
"I don't know. This isn't how I wanted to tell people. I thought we'd get a chance to do this right."
Something softens and resolves in her face, and he suspects he's answered a question for her beyond the one she asked. She reaches over and covers one of his hands with her own.
"You listen to me," she says.
Her jaw is set, ironclad. It's the game face he's seen her use to stare down Congress, to cow autocrats. Her grip on his hand is steady and strong. He wonders, half hysterically, if this is how it felt to charge into war under Washington.
"I am your mother. I was your mother before I was ever the president, and I'll be your mother long after, to the day they put me in the ground and beyond this earth. You are my child. So, if you're serious about this, I'll back your play."
Alex is silent.
"But the debates," he thinks, "but the general..."
Her gaze is hard. He knows better than to say either of those things. She'll handle it.
"So," she says, "do you feel forever about him?"
and there's no room left to agonize over it. Nothing left to do but say the thing he's known all along.
Yeah, he says. I do.
Ellen Claremont exhales slowly, and she grins a small, secret grin, the crooked, unflattering one she never uses in public, the one he knows best from when he was a kid around her knees in a small kitchen in Travis County.
Then fuck it.
The Washington Post. As details emerge about Alex Claremont Diaz's affair with Prince Henry, White House goes silent. September 27th, 2020. Thinking about history makes me wonder how I'll fit into it one day, I guess. First son Alex Claremont Diaz writes in one of the many emails to Prince Henry published by the Daily Mail this morning. And you too. It seems the answer to that question may have come sooner than any anticipated with a sudden exposure of the first son's romantic relationship with Prince Henry, an arrangement with major repercussions for two of the world's most powerful nations, less than 2 months before the United States casts its vote on President Claremont's second term. As security experts within the FBI and the Claremont administration scramble to find the sources that provided the British tabloid with evidence of the affair, the usually high-profile first family has shuddered, with no official statement from the first son. The first family has always and continues to keep their personal lives separate from the political and diplomatic dealings of the presidency, White House Press Secretary David Sutherland said in a brief prepared statement this morning. They ask for patience and understanding from the American people as they handle this very private matter. The Daily Mail's report this morning revealed that first son Alex Claremont Diaz has been involved romantically and sexually with Prince Henry since at least February of this year, according to emails and photographs obtained by the paper. The full email transcripts have been uploaded to WikiLeaks under the moniker The Waterloo Letters, seemingly named for a reference to the Waterloo Vase in the Buckingham Palace Gardens in one email composed by Prince Henry. The correspondence continues regularly up to Sunday night and appears to have been lifted from a private email server used by residents of the White House. Setting aside the ramifications for President Claremont's ability to be impartial on issues of both international relations and traditional family values, Republican presidential candidate Senator Jeffrey Richards said at a press conference earlier today, I'm extremely concerned about this private email server. What kind of information was being disseminated on this server? Richards added that he believes the American voters have a right to know everything else for which President Claremont's server may have been used. Sources close to the Claremont administration insist the private server is similar to the one set up during President George W. Bush's administration and used only for communication within the White House about day-to-day operations and personal correspondence for the first family and core White House personnel. First round of examination of the Waterloo letters by experts have yet to reveal any evidence of classified information or otherwise compromising content outside of the nature of the first son's relationship with Prince Henry. For 5 endless, unbearable hours, Alex is shuffled from room to room in the West Wing, meeting with what seemed to be every strategist, press staffer, and crisis manager his mother's administration has to offer. The only moment he recalls with any clarity is pulling his mother into an alcove to say, I told Raf. She stares at him. You told Rafael Luna that you're bisexual? I told Rafael Luna about Henry, he says flatly, 2 days ago. She doesn't ask why, just sighs grimly, and they both hover over the implication before she says, No. These pictures were taken before that. It couldn't have been him. He runs through pro and con lists, models of different outcomes, fucking charts and graphs and more data than he has ever wanted to see about his own relationship and its ramifications for the world around him. This is the damage you cause, Alex, it all seems to say, right there in hard facts and figures. This is who you hurt. He hates himself, but he doesn't regret anything. And maybe that makes him a bad person and a worse politician, but he doesn't regret Henry. For 5 endless, unbearable hours, he's not allowed to even try to contact Henry. The press sec drafts a statement. It looks like any other memo. For 5 hours, he doesn't shower or change his clothes or laugh or smile or cry. It's 8 in the morning when he's finally released and told to stay in the residence and stand by for further instructions. He's handed his phone, at last, but there's no answer when he calls Henry, and no response when he texts. Nothing at all. Amy walks with him through the colonnade and up the stairs, saying nothing, and when they reach the hallway between the east and west bedrooms, he sees them. June, her hair in a haphazard knot on the top of her head and in a pink bathrobe, her eyes red-rimmed. His mom, in a sharp, no-nonsense black dress and pointed heels, jaw set. Leo, barefoot in his pajamas. And his dad, a leather duffel still hanging off one shoulder, looking harried and exhausted. They all turn to look at him, and Alex feels a wave of something so much bigger than himself sweep over him. Like when he was a child standing bow-legged in the Gulf of Mexico, riptides sucking at his feet. A sound escapes his throat uninvited, something that he barely even recognizes, and June has him first, then the rest of them, arms and arms and hands, pulling him close and touching his face and moving him until he's on the floor. The goddamn terrible, hideous antique rug that he hates, sitting on the floor and staring at the rug and the threads of the rug and hearing the Gulf rushing in his ears and thinking distantly that he's having a panic attack. And that's why he can't breathe. But he's just staring at the rug, and he's having a panic attack, and knowing why his lungs won't work doesn't make them work again. He's faintly aware of being shifted into his room, to his bed, which is still covered in the godforsaken fucking newspapers, and someone guides him onto it. And he sits down and tries very hard to make a list in his head. One. He sleeps in fits and starts, wakes up sweating, wakes up shivering, his dreams in short, fractured scenes that swell and fade erratically. He dreams of himself at war, in a muddy trench, love letters soaking red in his chest pocket. He dreams of a house in Travis County, doors locked, unwilling to let him in again. He dreams of a crown. He dreams once, briefly, of the lake house, an orange beacon under the moon. He sees himself there, standing in water up to his neck. He sees Henry, sitting naked on the pier. He sees June and Nora, hands clasped together, and Pez on the grass between them. And B, digging pink fingertips into the wet soil. In the trees next to them, he hears the snap, snap, snap of branches. "Look," Henry says, pointing up at the stars. And Alex tries to say, "Don't you hear it?" Tries to say, "Something's coming." He opens his mouth, a spill of fireflies, and nothing. When he opens his eyes, June is sitting up against the pillows next to him, bitten nails pressed against her bottom lip, still in her bathrobe and keeping watch. She reaches down and squeezes his hand. He squeezes back. Between dreams, he catches the sound of muffled voices in the hallway. "Nothing," Zara's voice is saying. "Not a thing. Nobody is taking our calls." "How can they not be taking our calls? I'm the goddamn president." "Permission to do a thing, ma'am. Slightly outside diplomatic protocol." A comment. "First Family has been lying to us, the American people." One. "What else are they lying about?" A tweet. "I knew it. I knew Alex was gay. I told you bitches." A comment. "My 12-year-old daughter has been crying all day. She's dreamt of marrying Prince Henry since she was a little girl. She is heartbroken." A comment. "Are we really supposed to believe that no federal funds were used to cover this up?" A tweet. LMAO. Wait, look at page 22 of the emails. "Alex is such a hoe." A tweet. OMFG. "Did you see? Somebody who went to uni with Henry posted some photos of him at a party, and he is just, like, profoundly gay in them. I'm screaming."
A tweet. Read my column with @WSJ on what the hashtag Waterloo letters say about the inner workings of the Claremont White House. More comments. Slurs. Lies. June takes his phone away and shoves it under a couch cushion. He doesn't bother protesting. Henry's not going to call. At 1 in the afternoon, for the second time in 12 hours, Zara bursts through his bedroom door. "Pack a bag," she says. "We're going to London." June helps him stuff a backpack with jeans and a pair of shoes and a broken-in copy of Prisoner of Azkaban, and he stumbles into a clean shirt and out of his room. Zara is waiting in the hall with her own bag and a freshly pressed suit of Alex's, a sensible navy one that she has apparently decided is appropriate for meeting the Queen. She's told him very little, except that Buckingham Palace has shut down communication channels in and out, and they're just going to show up and demand a meeting. She seems confident Sean will agree to it, and willing to physically overpower him if not. The feeling rolling around in his gut is bizarre. His mom has signed off on them going public with the truth, which is incredible. But there's no reason to expect that from the Crown. He could get marching orders to deny everything. He thinks he might grab Henry and run if it comes down to that. He's almost completely sure Henry wouldn't go along with pretending it was all fake. He trusts Henry, and he believes in him. But they were also supposed to have more time. There's a secluded side entrance of the residence that Alex can sneak out of without being seen, and June and his parents meet him there.
"I know this is scary," his mom says, "but you can handle it."
"Give 'em hell," his dad adds.
June hugs him, and he shoves on his sunglasses and a hat and jogs out the door and toward whatever way this is all going to end. Cash and Amy are waiting on the plane. Alex wonders briefly if they volunteered for the assignment, but he's trying to get his emotions back under control, and that's not going to help. He bumps his fist against Cash's as he passes, and Amy nods up from the denim jacket she's needling yellow flowers into. It's all happened so quickly that now, knees curled up to his chin as they leave the ground, is the first time Alex is able to actually think about everything. He's not, he thinks, upset people know. He's always been pretty unapologetic when it came to things like who he dates and what he's into, although those were never anything like this. Still, the cocky shithead part of him is slightly pleased to finally have a claim on Henry. Yep, the prince. Most eligible bachelor in the world, British accent, face like a Greek god, legs for days. Mine. But that's only a tiny, tiny fraction of it. The rest is a knot of fear, anger, violation, humiliation, uncertainty, panic. There are the flaws everyone's allowed to see. His big mouth, his mercurial temper, his searing impulses. And then there's this. It's like how he only wears his glasses when nobody's around. Nobody's supposed to see how much he needs. He doesn't care that people think about his body and write about his sex life, real or imagined. He cares that they know, in his own private words, what's pumping out of his heart. And Henry, God, Henry, those emails, those letters, were the one place Henry could say what he was really thinking. There's nothing that wasn't laid out in there. Henry being gay, B going to rehab, the Queen tacitly keeping Henry in the closet. Alex hasn't been a good Catholic in a long time, but he knows confession is a sacrament. They were supposed to stay safe. Fuck. He can't sit still. He tosses Prisoner of Azkaban aside after 4 pages. He encounters a thick piece on his own relationship on Twitter and has to shut down the whole app. He paces up and down the aisle of the jet, kicking at the bottom of the seats.
"Can you please sit down?"
Zara says after 20 minutes of watching him twitch around the cabin.
"You're giving my ulcer an ulcer." "Are you sure they're going to let us in when we get there?"
Alex asks her. "Like, what if they don't? What if they, like, call the Royal Guard on us and have us arrested?
Can they do that?
Amy could probably fight them. Will she get arrested if she tries to fight them?"
"For fuck's
sake!
Zara groans, and she pulls out her phone and starts dialing.
Who are you calling?
She sighs, holding the phone up to her ear as it rings.
Srivastava.
What makes you think he'll answer?
It's his personal line.
Alex stares at her.
You have his personal line and you haven't used it until now?
Sean, Zara snaps. Listen up, you fuck. We are in the air right now. F. Sotis is with me. ETA 6 hours. You will have a car waiting. We will meet the Queen and whoever the fuck else we have to meet to hash this shit out, or so help me God, I will personally make your balls into fucking earrings. I will scorched earth your entire motherfucking life.
She pauses, presumably to listen to him agree, because Alex can't imagine him doing anything else.
Now, put Henry on the phone and do not try to tell me he's not there because I know you haven't let him out of your sight.
And she shoves her phone at Alex's face. He takes it uncertainly and lifts it to his ear. There's rustling, a confused noise.
Hello?
It's Henry's voice. Sweet and posh and shaky and confused, and relief knocks the wind out of him.
Sweetheart.
He hears Henry's exhale over the line.
Hi, love. Are you okay?
He laughs wetly, amazed.
Fuck, are you kidding me? I'm fine.
Are you okay?
I'm managing.
Alex winces.
How bad is it?
Philip broke a vase that belonged to Anne Boleyn. Gran ordered a communications lockdown, and Mum hasn't spoken to anyone, Henry tells him. But, other than that, all things considered,
I know, Alex says. I'll be there soon. There's another pause. Henry's breath shaking over the receiver.
I'm not sorry, he says, that people know.
Alex feels his heart climb up into his throat.
Henry, he attempts, I talked to my mom. I know the timing isn't ideal. Would you?
I won't. Hang on, Alex says. Are we both asking the same thing?
That depends. Were you going to ask me if I want to tell the truth?
Yeah, Alex says, and he thinks his knuckles must be white around the phone.
Yeah.
I was.
Then, yes.
A breath, barely.
You want that?
Henry takes a moment to respond, but his voice is level.
I don't know if I would have chosen it yet, but it's out there now, and I won't lie. Not about this. Not about you.
Alex's eyelashes are wet.
I fucking love you.
I love you, too. Just hold on until I get there. We're gonna figure this out.
I will.
I'm coming. I'll be there soon.
Henry exhales a wet, broken laugh.
Please do hurry.
They hang up, and he passes the phone back to Zara, who takes it wordlessly and tucks it back into her bag.
Thank you, Zara.
She holds up one hand, eyes closed.
Don't. Seriously, you didn't have to do that.
Look, I'm only going to say this once, and if you ever repeat it, I'll have you kneecapped. She drops her hand, fixing him with a glare that manages to be both chilly and fond.
I'm rooting for you. Okay?
Wait. Zara, oh my God, I just realized.
You're my friend.
No, I'm not.
Zara, you're my mean friend.
Am not. She yanks a blanket from her pile of belongings, turning her back to Alex and wrapping it around her.
Don't speak to me for the next 6 hours. I deserve a fucking nap.
Wait, Alex says. I have one question. She sighs heavily.
What?
Why'd you wait to use Sean's personal number?
Because he's my fiancé, asshole. But some of us understand the meaning of discretion, so you wouldn't know about it.
she tells him without even so much as looking at him, curled up against the window of the plane. We agreed we'd never use our personal numbers for work contact. Now shut up and let me get some sleep before we have to deal with the rest of this. I'm running on nothing but black coffee, a Wetzel's pretzels, and a fistful of B12. Do not even breathe in my direction. It's not Henry, but B, who answers when Alex knocks on the closed door of the music room on the second floor of Kensington. I told you to stay away, B is saying as soon as the door is open, brandishing a guitar over her shoulder. She drops it as soon as she sees him.
Oh, Alex, I'm so sorry. I thought you were Philip.
She scoops him up with her free hand into a surprisingly bone-crushing hug.
Thank God you're here. I was about to come get you myself.
When she releases him, he's finally able to see Henry behind her, slumped on the settee with a bottle of brandy. He smiles at Alex weakly and says,
"Bit short for a stormtrooper."
Alex's laugh comes out half-sob, and it's impossible to know if he moves first or if Henry does, but they meet in the middle of the room. Henry's arms around Alex's neck, swallowing him up. If Henry's voice on the phone was a tether, his body is the gravity that makes it possible. His hand gripping the back of Alex's neck, a magnetic force, a permanent compass north.
I'm sorry,
is what comes out of Alex's mouth, miserably, earnestly, muffled against Henry's throat. It's my fault. I'm so sorry. I'm so sorry. Henry releases him. Hands on his shoulders, jaw set.
Don't you dare. I'm not sorry for a thing.
Alex laughs again, incredulous, looking into the heavy circles under Henry's eyes and the chewed-up bottom lip, and for the first time, seeing a man born to lead a nation.
You're unbelievable,
Alex says. He leans up and kisses the underside of his jaw, finding it rough from a full, fitful day without a shave. He pushes his nose, his cheek into it, feels some of the tension sap out of Henry's at the touch.
You know that?
They find their way onto the lush purples and reds of the Persian rugs on the floor. Henry's head in Alex's lap and B on a poof, plucking away at a weird little instrument she tells Alex is called an autoharp. B pulls over a tiny table and sets out crackers and a little chunk of soft cheese and takes away the brandy bottle. From the sound of it, the Queen is absolutely livid. Not just to finally have confirmation about Henry, but because it's via something as undignified as a tabloid scandal. Philip drove in from Anmer Hall the minute the news broke and has been rebuffed by B every time he tries to get near Henry for what he says will simply be a stern discussion about the consequences of his actions. Catherine has been by once, 3 hours ago, stone-faced and sad, to tell Henry that she loves him, and he could have told her sooner.
And I said, "That's great, Mum, but as long as you're letting Gran keep me trapped, it doesn't mean a fucking thing,"
Henry says. Alex stares down at him, shocked and a little impressed. Henry rests an arm over his face.
"I feel awful. I don't know. All the times she should have been there the past few years, it caught up to me."
B sighs.
"Maybe it was the kick in the arse she needs. We've been trying to get her to do anything for years since Dad."
"Still," Henry says, "the way Gran is, Mom isn't to blame for that. And she did manage to protect us before. It's not fair."
"H," B says firmly, "it's hard. But she needed to hear it."
She looks down at the little buttons of the auto harp.
"We deserve to have one parent, at least."
The corner of her mouth pinches, so much like Henry's.
"Are you okay?"
Alex asks her. I
saw a couple articles."
He doesn't finish the sentence. The powder princess was the fourth highest Twitter trend 10 hours ago. Her frown twitches into a half-smile.
"Me? Honestly, it's almost a relief. I've always said that the most comfortable I could be is everyone knowing my story up front, so I don't have to hear the speculations or lie to cover the truth or explain it. I'd rather it, hadn't been this way. But here we are,
At least now I can stop acting as if it's something to be ashamed of. I know the feeling, Henry says softly. The quiet ebbs and flows after a while. The London night black and pressing in against the window panes. David the Beagle curls up protectively at Henry's side, and Bee picks a Bowie song to play. She sings under her breath, I will be king, and you will be queen. And Alex almost laughs. It feels like how Zara has described hurricane days to him, stuck together, hoping the sandbags will hold. Henry drifts asleep at some point, and Alex is thankful for it, but he can still feel tension in every part of Henry's body against him. He hasn't slept since the news, Bee tells him quietly. Alex nods slightly, searching her face. Can I ask you something? Always. I feel like he's not telling me something, Alex whispers. I believe him when he says he's in, and he wants to tell everyone the truth, but there's something else he's not saying, and it's freaking me out that I can't figure out what it is. Bee looks up, her fingers stilling. Oh, love, she says simply. He misses Dad. Oh. He sighs, putting his head in his hands. Of course. Can you explain, he attempts lamely, what that's like? What I can do? She shifts on her poof, repositioning the harp onto the floor, and reaches into her sweater. She withdraws a silver coin on a chain, her sobriety chip. Do you mind if I go a bit sponsor? She asks with a smirk. He offers her a weak half-smile, and she continues. So, imagine we're all born with a set of feelings. Some are broader or deeper than others, but for everyone, there's that ground floor, a bottom crust of the pie. That's the maximum depth of feeling you've ever experienced. And then, the worst thing happens to you. The very worst thing that could have happened. The thing you had nightmares about as a child, and you thought, it's all right because that thing will happen to me when I'm older and wiser, and I'll have felt so many feelings by then that this one worst feeling, the worst possible feeling, won't seem so terrible. But it happens to you when you're young. It happens when your brain isn't even fully done cooking, when you've barely experienced anything, really. The worst thing is one of the first big things that ever happens to you in your life. It happens to you, and it goes all the way down to the bottom of what you know how to feel, and it rips it open and carves out this chasm down below to make room. And because you were so young, and because it was one of the first things to happen in your life, you will always carry it inside you. Every time something terrible happens to you from then on, it doesn't just stop at the bottom. It goes all the way down. She reaches across the tiny tea table and the sad little pile of water crackers and touches the back of Alex's hand. Do you understand? She asks him, looking right into his eyes. You need to understand this to be with Henry. He is the most loving, nurturing, selfless person you could hope to meet. But there is a sadness and a hurt in him that is tremendous, and you may very well never truly understand it, but you need to love it as much as you love the rest of him, because that's him. That is him, part and parcel. And he is prepared to give it all to you, which is far more than I ever in 1,000 years thought I would see him do. Alex sits, trying for a long moment to absorb it, and says, I haven't been through anything like that, he says, voice rough. But I've always felt it, in him. There's this side of him that's unknowable. He takes a breath. But the thing is, jumping off cliffs is kind of my thing. That's the choice. I love him with all that, because of all that, on purpose. I love him on purpose. Bee smiles gently. Then you'll do fine. Sometime around 4 in the morning, he climbs into bed behind Henry.
Henry, whose spine pokes out in soft points. Henry, who has been through the worst thing, and now the next worst thing, and is still alive. He reaches out a hand and touches the ridge of Henry's shoulder blade, the skin where the sheet has slid off him, where his lungs stubbornly refuse to stop pulling air. 6 feet of boy, curled around kicked-in ribs and a recalcitrant heart. Carefully, his chest to Henry's back, he slots himself into place.
"It's foolishness, Henry," Philip is saying. "You're too young to understand."
Alex's ears are ringing. They sat down in Henry's kitchen this morning with scones and a note from Bea that she'd gone to meet with Catherine. And then suddenly, Philip was bursting through the door, suit askew, hair uncombed, shouting at Henry about the nerve to break the communications embargo, to bring Alex here while the palace is being watched, to keep embarrassing the family. Presently, Alex is thinking about breaking his nose with a coffee percolator.
"I'm 23, Philip,"
Henry says, audibly struggling to keep his voice even.
"Mom was barely more than that when she met Dad."
"Yes, and you think that was a wise decision?" Philip says nastily.
"Marrying a man who spent half our childhoods making films, who never served his country, who got sick and left us and Mum?"
"Don't, Philip," Henry says, "I swear to God.
Just because your obsession with family legacy didn't impress him, you clearly don't know the first fucking thing about what a legacy means if you can let something like this happen."
Philip snaps. "The only thing to do now is bury it and hope that somehow people will believe that none of it was real.
That's your duty, Henry. It's the least you can do."
"I'm sorry," Henry says, sounding wretched, but there's a bitter defiance rising in him too. "I'm sorry that I'm such a disgrace.